part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. You're tuned to listener-supported radio station WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. There are just now hours left until the end of our fiscal year, and we are $42,000 away from our listener support goal of $800,000. To maintain all the programs you value, we've got to close this gap, and we have some friends who are going to help us make this goal. Case and Elaine Sprinkle and Don and Carolyn Mullally will add $1,500 to our dollar total when our total dollars in the bank reaches $800,000. Another donor has called to join the Sprinkles and the Mullallys in their challenge. He will contribute $800 when we reach $800,000. So that challenge, these two challenges now, worth $2,300. Call 217-244-9455. That's 244-WILL or 217-333-0850 with a credit card contribution. Or you can go online to WILL.UIUC.edu and help WILL meet this challenge and push closer to the June 30th goal of having $800,000 in the bank to pay for programming here next year on AM 580. Thank you. Music from the movie Blade Runner to get us started here this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. A professor of physics at Emory University, Sidney Perkowitz, estimates that between 8 and 10% of us have some sort of artificial part. He says these bionic parts include functional prosthetic devices and implants, as well as cosmetic additions, including false hair and breast augmentation. What's on the horizon? Well, Professor Perkowitz says bionic brains. He says there will be ways to alter or augment mental capacity and emotional states from implanted drug delivery systems to computer chips connected directly to the neural network. This afternoon, we'll talk with Sidney Perkowitz about bionics, robotics, and artificial intelligence, the subject of his new book, Digital People, From Bionic Humans to Androids. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Sidney Perkowitz. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He has written and presented articles and commentary for broadcast and print. His books include Empire of Light, about science and art, and Universal Foam, from cappuccino to the cosmos. Professor Perkowitz's latest book, Digital People, is published by the Joseph Henry Press, an imprint of the National Academies Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Perkowitz, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Bionic brains, you know, I can't help but think of the Stepford Wives, who are either transformed by some kind of brain augmentation or are androids. A couple of questions here. You know, it seems like we're still very much in the realm of science fiction. So how far do you think artificial brain alterations may go? And how far over the horizon are androids, like the Stepford Wives, if they are androids, or like Star Trek's Data?
It does sound like science fiction. In fact, it's one of the fascinating things about this area of technology, how it has deep roots in science fiction. But we've actually made a real-world progress toward the kind of achievements you're talking about. We do have ways to connect animal brains and people's brains to electronic devices, for instance, and I believe that's the beginning of something really substantial.
Yeah. Now, I would imagine that there's a variety of opinion as to what's possible and what's desirable. What's the current range of opinion out there about what is possible and what's desirable?
It's all over the lot. You're exactly right about that. One of the burning issues is, or let's say two related burning issues are, can we make an artificial brain as intelligent and as conscious as a human one? And if we do connect human brains to artificial devices, are we not changing humanity in a terrible, terrible way? And the range of opinion on all of that is from this is wonderful, we can't wait, it's humanity's destiny, to this is the worst idea of all time, and anyway, we can't make it happen. So you can pick anything you like from one end to the other.
Yeah. Well, and it's a thing that has intrigued us for a long time. You write about this in the book Digital People. You can go back to the ancient Greeks, and then you can go to the theaters today and see the Stepford Wives. There are the androids of Blade Runner, and there's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. What is involved in our interest in artificial creatures? It's intrigued us for a very long time.
It's a fascinating question, and I myself was startled to find out how far back it goes. As you said, Greek mythology has references to bionic creatures and to robots. In fact, there's an actual metal robot that's a part of Greek mythology. But, you know, Celeste, if you expand your thinking and think that what came before robots, well, maybe it was puppets and dolls, then you understand how far back this goes and that there are ways to engage human emotions even by artificial beings. In fact, you can take it further because some of us just love our machines. I have a sports car that I like a lot, and I find myself caressing the fender occasionally. So there is something about artificiality when it starts to look human or natural that really, really pulls us in.
Yeah. At the outset of the book, you say seeing a robot called Cog gave you goosebumps. Tell us about Cog, and how do you explain the goosebumps?
Yes, it was quite a moment, and let me describe Cog and then describe the situation. Maybe the listeners will understand what I meant. Cog was a robot built at MIT. Cog stands for cognitive. He looks like the upper half of a human being from the waist up. He doesn't look very human, although it's a human outline in general, but this is a machine. It's made out of steel and electronics and photocells for eyes and so on. But what Cog does is the same thing humans do. If you leave it alone, that doesn't mean it's just sitting there. Its eyes move around the room to see what's interesting. And the moment that gave me goosebumps was Cog was sitting in the lab, the door opened, a graduate student walked in, Cog noticed that and immediately turned its, or maybe his, head toward the student and gazed at her directly. And that was such a moment of human action that it absolutely made my hair stand on end.
Yeah. Now, does Cog have the same impact on everyone?
I couldn't vouch that Cog does on everyone, but there's another robot made at MIT called Kismet, which has facial expressions and reacts rather the way a small child would. If you play with it, it likes it. If you ignore it, it begins to sulk. And humans react to Kismet very, very strongly. The most telling part of the reaction is that when women speak to Kismet, many of them lapse into baby talk automatically. And that's just remarkable that a machine can elicit a response like this.
Yeah. But, you know, as you pointed out, you know, we develop attachments to things, to objects, and toys are such a thing. Dolls, as you mentioned, and the robotic pets that are out there on the market now. But, you know, in the end, they're clearly objects. I mean, no child would confuse a real baby with a doll or a computer-chipped up pet with the family cat or dog, right?
I agree. I think it's pretty clear that when a little girl is playing with a doll, she doesn't think the doll really is a baby. But nevertheless, it pulls out some of the same emotions. And now there is some evidence, some recent psychological evidence, that very young children who have been brought up with robot dogs as part of their lives and robot cats have a little bit of confusion about what's really living and what's machine-like. So it may be that the barriers are eroding a little bit.
Oh, that's interesting. Alan Turing posed a famous question in 1950, the mathematician, known now as the Turing test. Can machines think? What does the Turing test require for an answer in the affirmative?
Alan Turing was a very brilliant British mathematician, and his name lives because of the Turing test. His brilliance really deserves to be recognized. The Turing test is this. If you want to tell if a machine or a robot is intelligent, you put it behind a screen so you can't see it. You have a human communicate with it through a keyboard and a monitor, and just let the human ask any question he or she would like to. If after 15 or 20 minutes or half an hour, the human can tell if he's speaking to another human or a machine, you ought to consider the machine human or as intelligent as a human. That's the Turing test. It has yet to be passed. So although we've made a lot of progress, we are not yet satisfying Alan Turing's criterion for machine intelligence.
Mm. Now, machine intelligence, machines thinking, does this include self-awareness?
I would separate those two a little bit. I think we're clearer on what intelligence is, and in my opinion, we already have machine intelligence, and I'll be glad to give some examples. Self-consciousness is a different thing. It's much harder to define. In fact, if you really think about it, Celeste, although each of us knows we ourselves have thoughts and feelings inside, we really are not sure that other people do. We assume they do. We assume we're all made the same, but it's really not clear that they do. So human consciousness is a more complicated, more controversial thing. I think we already have machine intelligence. We may never have machine consciousness.
Mm, okay. So give us some examples of machine intelligence.
Well, the way I like to frame it is to go back to the work of Howard Gardner. This is the Harvard psychologist who made a big splash, and deservedly so, because he said, you know, intelligence is not just one thing. It's seven different categories, such things as verbal ability, mathematical ability, spatial ability, which is ability to move in an area, know where you are, musical ability, one, and I think three others. If I look around at the two or three smartest robots in the world now, I believe among them they have five or six. They show traces of five or six of those seven basic kinds of intelligence. They're robots that can hold a conversation, robots that can walk through a room and not bump into anything, robots that have a visual ability. In fact, the two Mars rovers now exploring that planet are robots with strong visual intelligence.
Yeah, and there are some machines with intelligence that, well, I guess you could say they were equipped with some kind of intelligence, probably not great intelligence, but aren't those little vacuum cleaners that are out there now, with that and lawnmowers, would they possess some kind of, would we call that intelligence?
I think you would say that vacuum cleaner, which is done pretty well, it's called Roomba, and it also comes from ideas at MIT, has a low level of spatial intelligence. You put it in a room, it figures out the best way to work out a pattern that will cover the room and sweep up all or most of the dirt, reaching every corner in the room. So, yes, there's some kind of low-level intelligence going on. Now, let's be realistic. A cockroach can do as well. So this is not the level of intelligence of a brilliant human navigator,
right.
But still it's a first step.
Yeah, yeah. Well, cockroaches do possess some intelligence.
Yes.
As do all the creatures of the world, I would say. What about the issue of plasticity? That is, a machine's ability to react to new situations. Perhaps we could think about this in terms of learning ability.
Oh, let's talk about that because it's really important for humans, and I think it would be important if we ever want to make truly smart machines. So, in humans, plasticity means the neurons in your brain and the connections among them are not fixed. The connections change as you grow older and as you learn. In fact, this is a significant part of our whole learning process. Artificial brains don't yet work that way. When you make a computer chip with a million circuits in it, those circuits are etched forever. They don't alter themselves. But there are people now making computer chips that can change their own circuits as they work, as they process information. So to my mind, we're beginning to see evidence of machine plasticity as well as human plasticity.
Mm. And that is really important. And as you write about at the close of the book, it might be necessary to truly have an artificially intelligent being, if I could use that word, being, that it might require the kind of guidance that parents give children, human parents give their children. And that's one of the fascinating things. Here we go back to the movies, about the movie AI.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because it gives one more chance to say what a brilliant guy Alan Turing was, because 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago, when he first started thinking about artificial minds, among other conclusions, he said, you know, you'll never get full human intelligence unless you take this brain and raise it the way you would a child. Now, AI is about a child android, but you know, that child doesn't learn a great deal as he gets older. In fact, he doesn't get older. He doesn't learn a great deal as time goes on. So he actually is maybe not the best example of this kind of behavior. But if we think back to the movie 2001, which had HAL, an artificial mind, in it, people might recall the scene where the astronaut has to pull out HAL's memory chips because HAL has gotten murderous. HAL has turned into a murderer. He's murdered a human being. As the chips are pulled out, HAL regresses, and he goes back, finally, in his last few words, saying how he was raised and taught a song by an instructor when he was a very young baby computer. So that movie actually has a little bit of training like a child built into it. I don't think it's been noticed very much, but I noticed it when I wrote the book.
Yeah. What are the questions that we're confronting or beginning to confront in terms of the introduction of robots and androids in the book? You just mentioned the HAL of 2001. There is also, I've just lost it, but I know what I was going to bring up. Asimov's rules of robotics.
This is another one of these science fiction ideas that is beginning to take on reality. Asimov wrote a famous series of stories about robots called I, Robot. And by the way, there's a movie by that name coming out, I believe, in July, this summer. So listeners might be interested in knowing that Asimov still lives. Anyway, when Asimov invented his robot stories, he wanted to make sure that they couldn't hurt people. So he put in what have become known as Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. These are like the Ten Commandments for robots built into their brains. It prevents them from harming humans, basically, just expressed very strongly. You cannot harm humans. You cannot take commands that would let you harm a human. Well, again, it seems like science fiction, but just 3 or 4 months ago, I was at a conference about robotic ethics held in Italy. And the issue is, if we start to make these machines that are intelligent and they have some choice of action, how do we make sure they don't hurt people? Mm-hmm. And one serious proposal was, are Asimov's three laws really sufficient to form an ethical standard for robots? So there are many, many ethical issues. We're just beginning to understand what they might be, and people are just beginning to find what the answers might be.
Yeah. What's the current thinking on Asimov's laws of robotics? Are they sufficient, or are they lacking?
Well, they sound good on paper, but as one of the people at the conference pointed out, if you could make an artificial brain smart enough to understand a general law like you must not do an action that can harm a human, you already have a huge, huge level of artificial intelligence, and probably a level that Asimov's three laws couldn't control. You need to do something more subtle.
Yeah.
So again, we have a way to go. I think we barely, beyond the science fiction end of the spectrum, we barely started to think about these issues. Let me point out also, just to expand all our thinking about it, when we say a robot, we usually mean something that walks around on two legs and so on. But a robot could also be a robot weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a weapon that has been designed to seek out and maybe select targets, maybe with very general guidelines. So one of the issues at this conference on robotic ethics was, well, if we do have intelligent, quote-unquote, weaponry, is that okay? Does the Geneva Convention allow it, or is this a terrible, terrible direction for humanity to go?
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, for example, you could use robotic devices to clear landmines. Great idea, I think.
Right.
But you could have robotic weapons that could lead to greater civilian casualties. And then, too, well, what if we did have a self-aware robot? Would it be okay to send it into war?
Exactly right. If the robot behaves in that human a manner, then is there not something immoral about sending it off to be killed? If it's self-conscious, presumably its own death would mean something to it. So there's that question of the morality of how we treat these creatures. And then your other point may be even more significant. If a certain nation becomes so technologically advanced that it can use machines to carry on warfare, doesn't it become pretty easy to wipe the enemy off the face of the battlefield, and also to think that you can do it without the least bit of harm coming to your own people? That's a very, very dangerous kind of attitude to think about.
Yeah. Well, I think it has been said that with the mechanization of war, soldiers do better and civilians fare not so well.
You protect the soldiers, but that means that the soldiers can inflict more harm on the humans without being hurt themselves. And then there's the other issue. I haven't been in the military myself, but you hear this said very, very often. It's one thing to push a button and drop a bomb and wipe out 1,000 faceless people. That's technology doing it. It's another thing to see someone face to face and to have and be told you must kill that person.
Yeah.
When you get that distance, you have a different kind of reaction to warfare.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Sidney Perkowitz. He's a professor of physics at Emory University. His latest book is Digital People, From Bionic Humans to Androids. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. We have some listeners lined up and ready to talk with us this afternoon. Let's go and talk with our first caller today on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but it goes back to something you were at least alluding to earlier. I saw on, I don't know if it's PBS or Discovery Channel somewhere, they had put in some sort of Petri dish a microcircuit and then also introduced neurological tissue, and it started growing in the dish and connecting itself to the microcircuit. They didn't explain the process that was causing this to happen, nor, you know, how it would interact in terms of some functional process. I wonder if you could talk about that. Also, it's now understood that actually the majority of communication that goes on in the central nervous system isn't electrical across synapses, but rather it's chemical peptides that are interacting at some distance. And I'm just wondering if there's any work to try to find a way also for some kind of, you know, bionics to work with that as well.
I think I can respond to both of those. So the first part about neurons and electronic circuits in Petri dishes absolutely exists. My book talked about a German researcher named Peter Fromhertz, who grows neurons, not human neurons, animal neurons, on ordinary computer chips. The chips and the neurons can talk to each other directly because, although chemistry is involved in transmission of neural signals, in the last analysis, it's an electrical signal. So the chip and the neuron talk to each other. And Dr. Fromhertz's vision is that someday it might be possible to patch brain injuries with pieces of silicon. What he's done is to put two neurons on a silicon chip, and the neurons talk to each other through the chip. Even if they're not connected in a neural way, they can still communicate. So that's the promise. He's still a long way to go, but this work is absolutely remarkable, and he's not the only one doing it. And the issue you raised about it really being chemistry, not not electricity, that's certainly true, but again, the final result is electricity. And when you have electricity, then you can connect to an electronic device.
A lot of what goes on is not just between neurons. There's also a number of actually neurons are a minority of the cells in the central nervous system, and now it's starting to be understood that there's a lot of important other kinds of communication taking place there that's not between synapses. And I wonder if you know anybody's trying to work with that as well.
Well, I'm not aware of work like that, but you know, you might have raised a point that shows one more way where the computer style of thinking and the human style of thinking really have a long way to go before they are at all similar.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Belgium, Illinois, on the toll-free line, line 4. Go ahead.
Yes. Earlier, you alluded to the fact that you didn't want these robots to harm people.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think probably one of the more basic questions we want to approach is that we as humans have damaged our environment plenty bad enough. Wouldn't you really want those folks not to damage that? Even the manufacture of them might be enough to, you know, cause more problems, as we do with, you know, making steel causes its sort of problems.
Well, you know, I have no doubt that, like any technology in the world, you can have bad outcomes and good outcomes. The thing that's a little bit different here, at least in my mind, is when you make an intelligent artificial creature, then it has some element of choice. I mean, intelligent behavior always involves choice. And if there's choice involved, then you don't know exactly what it's going to do. So we have the science fiction image of robots going berserk and killing humans. I don't think we're talking about that, but we're talking about a robot maybe thinking it can navigate through an area properly and not realizing that it's going to step on someone along the way, or even choosing to shake hands with you and just putting on too much pressure. So you can think of lots of ways where a humanoid kind of being can create harm because it can do choice and it has some power.
Well, I was referring, sir, to just the existence of them would cause that much more burden on our already limited resources on this planet.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Well, that can be argued a lot of different ways, sir. I mean, one argument is, you know, if we can do labor, especially repetitive and labor that's potentially dangerous by robotic machines, why, that's a plus for humanity. And maybe you've released people to do more interesting things with their lives. On the other hand, those same robotic workers might replace human workers. So I think there's a lot of black and white, a lot of good and potential bad mixed in the whole issue of developing this technology.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana, caller on line 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. Well. First of all, you know, Hal, the computer from 2001, he was born right here in Urbana, Illinois.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten that. Thank you for reminding us.
Yeah, we put them together. You know, if you're talking about androids, you know, another excellent example from the movies is RoboCop, who was in the movie an actual police officer who was almost killed, and they had to kind of take what they could salvage and put his what they could salvage from his body and put it inside a robot. But the thing is, they did some of that iRobot kind of stuff, and they hooked up some circuits to enforce laws on him. And so at some point he decided that, you know, the system had gone bad and he needed to rebel against it. And then at one point he had to shoot a police officer or some kill some politician or business executive or something, and he couldn't do it. He got this intense, you know, he got zapped with this intense voltage of electricity, the shock, and that was from the circuitry that they built into him to prevent him from doing that.
Well, you're absolutely right about RoboCop. He's in my book. He's one of my favorite science fiction characters along these lines. And he also had three laws implanted in him, not the same as Asimov's, but three laws that would make him an effective policeman. And among them was that he had to operate within legal guidelines. So, yes, whenever he would overstep one, the correct circuitry would snap into place and keep him from doing it. But, you know, at the end of the movie, he ends up being a very interesting character because although he looks very robotic and he's very powerful, and he has a built-in sidearm, his heart and his personality is still quite human. And what you see at the end of the movie is kind of an ideal merging of the machine and the human, which might actually be a guideline for how things might turn out in the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, as far as, you know, not so much androids, but just computers and full-on robots, probably in for the foreseeable future, the biggest problem is just going to be that, you know, the dang things are just too dumb. I mean, programming, you know, common, common sense is the most difficult thing to program into a computer. And the biggest problems that we're going to have, as opposed to, computers, like, actually thinking of bad things to do, is just making mistakes is going to be the number one thing. And I can even see, the companies or the government, companies that make these things, using that as an excuse to, a robot does some damage, and they say, oh, well, it's just not that smart. It didn't know what it was doing, so just give it an excuse. There's this joke in the world of computers and robots that human beings are the only self-regulating servo mechanism that can be mass-produced by unskilled labor. But anyway, I think it'll be a long time before there's lots of practical issues, and I think those will dominate for a long, long time.
Oh, I quite agree. I don't want anyone to have the idea that we're going to see really smart, capable machines walking around the corner anytime soon. But I think a lot of baby steps have been taken, and you and I probably both are of the same mind of how fast technology develops. So we might be surprised at how soon we begin to see really substantial intelligence.
All right. Well, this is a real interesting program. I enjoy listening to it.
Thank you. I assume you're talking in general also about this segment, so I'll say hello. I'll say thank you for both of us.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Okay, and thank you to our guest and to our caller, and let me invite others to join the discussion this afternoon. If you've got a question or comment for Sidney Perkowitz, author of Digital People, From Bionic Humans to Androids, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, one of the things that I think of here that the last caller, you and the last caller engaged about, was this idea of kind of a merging of human and machine, which we see in RoboCop, which we also saw years ago in the TV series The $6 Million Man and that kind of thing. And this is really interesting because, as I mentioned in my introduction, you foresee a time when there will be ways to alter or augment mental capacity and emotional states.
Yes, I think it can happen. It's always a question whether it really will be an improvement or an augmentation, but I think we certainly can change people at a mental level as well as a physical level. And to me, that's kind of the new qualitative breakthrough that we didn't have perhaps 10 or 20 years ago. We have had artificial arms and legs for a long time. Artificial hearts go way back, although they still need to be perfected. Pacemakers and that kind of thing all have a long history. But what's really new is the ability now to connect artificial things to the brain and nervous system of a human being. There are implants called cochlear implants. These are electronic devices that connect to the auditory nerve in deaf people and send to the nerve from microphones the same kind of impulses that the ears used to send and enable deaf people to hear. Not always perfectly, but certainly with sortly some degree of hearing. So this is a neural connection. And there are other kinds of neural connections being considered. For instance, there are people working in artificial implants for retinas for the blind. And this also has shown some promise. Again, not full vision, but glimmerings of vision. And there are even implants that put electrodes into animal brains and human brains, and these also seem to be functioning. So this is the new area, I think, that is the most fascinating, the scariest, and maybe has the biggest set of ethical issues around it.
Yeah, because this also could have the power to make us more intelligent, correct?
I think, at least at the science fiction level, it does, because what people envision is, if I can put electrodes in your head, well, why can't they just go to some kind of memory device and enlarge your memory, which is certainly part of intelligence. You have a bigger database to draw from. Again, as one of the previous callers pointed out, we're a long time away from this, but this breakthrough of being able to connect a piece of electronics directly to a brain, I think, is the first step in this technology.
Yeah. Here's a question that came to my mind as I was reading Digital People. If our machines are becoming ever more powerful, You know, like the computer that I have today is so much more powerful than I had 5 years ago. Will brain augmentation, and this is to leave the value judgment off the table here, will brain augmentation or alteration, that computing power, that recall power in our human brains, will it, could it become desirable, seen as desirable, even necessary, in order to keep up with the machines?
Well, that is a new idea that I hadn't thought of. So the machines may actually evolve, machine intelligence might evolve faster than our own intelligence is, I suppose, is what you're implying.
Yeah, either that or things are so complicated and there's so much machinery and it has so much power that we've got to be smarter to wrangle it.
So the answer might be, if machine power is seen as something different from humanity, maybe even a bit of an enemy or at least competitive, instead of trying to lick it, let's join it.
Hmm.
So we're back to the idea of perhaps emerging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, when you sit at your computer now, I mean, no way would I say that this is a bionic attachment or anything like it. You can get up anytime you want. But the computer makers, the software makers, and you yourself do everything possible to make the connection between you and the machine as seamless as possible. That's when you draw in the computer power the most and with the most ease, and it does you the most good. So extend that to having direct connections, and maybe that's a very smart direction for humanity to go. We actually merge with the machine at whatever level works for us.
Mm. Interesting. Well, it certainly raises more questions, doesn't it?
Yes.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi. I was wondering if you could comment on Stephen Wolfram's new kind of science, in the sense that, you know, a set of very simple rules can exhibit extremely complex behavior and intelligent behavior. Is this something that is a line of thought that is prevalent in artificial intelligence? I'll take the answer off there.
Well, you want to hang on just a second, because I'm not sure that I understand.
I didn't hear that clearly either.
Could
so
you
if we can
mention?
It, I'd appreciate
yeah.
it.
Could you mention the name of the person his work that you?
Right. Stephen Wolfram.
Wolfram. Okay.
He's a theoretic, very interesting person, very bright person. He was the person who invented a fabulous piece of software called Mathematica, which scientists use around the world. He wrote a book that claimed to describe a new kind of science that says the universe really operates very much like a computer. So, sir, is your question, do I believe that?
No. Yes, and in a way, is it something which can be applicable to artificial intelligence? Because in essence, what he says is that if you have a set of very simple rules, it can actually produce extremely complex and intelligent behavior.
Yes, I think you do hit the heart of what he said, and you said it better than I did. A set of very simple rules can lead to amazingly complex algorithms. Well, in a sense, I would say all computer thinking, quote-unquote, follows that behavior right now. Any program we know is made up of a series of simple steps. You put enough of them together, and you get something quite complex and maybe even almost unpredictable. But you still come down to that basic point, I think, one of those bones of contention that I mentioned before. No matter how complex the program is the computer or the robot really thinking, or is it just computing, which is at somehow a lower level than human thought? And I could give you the names of dozens of philosophers, psychologists, AI people, robotics people, computer science people, every one of whom has a different opinion about that. So I don't think I can summarize the general opinion. I don't think there is one. My own opinion is it doesn't matter. If the behavior is so complex that it seems intelligent and seems self-conscious, that's good enough for me.
Thank you for the call. Other questions, comments are invited for our guest, Sidney Perkowitz, this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Sidney Perkowitz, a professor of physics at Emory University. His latest book, Digital People from Bionic Humans to Androids. The work on brain augmentation and alteration, that research, is it providing insights into how the brain functions?
I think potentially it can, and one of the things I say in the book is even if you don't believe in robots and bionic people and cyborgs at a science fiction level, the level where really amazing things happen, this research still has value because it makes us learn more about ourselves. But in truth, I don't see much evidence yet that there's been any kind of breakthrough in thinking about how the human brain works from looking at robots. There was some in the past. 20, 30 years ago, when computers first became more prevalent, people modeled the human brain on the computer, tried to explain how the human brain worked in terms of the computer. That, I think, is a little passé now. The human brain is more complicated than that. So right now, I would only express the hope that research on the artificial side would enhance our knowledge of humanity, but I'm not sure it's happened yet.
Yeah. Well, perhaps it could as we continue work in an area that might repair damage, say brain damage, or restore or allow someone's sight. I would think that would be possible.
And, you know, that raises an important point, too. I mean, technology is often fascinating just on its own. You see very clever ideas, very clever scientists, engineers, and technologists. I interviewed some really brilliant people for the book. But technology doesn't become important in society until there's some economics driving it, too.
Hmm.
So if we're making robots just for the pleasure of doing it, that certainly has value, but it's not going to have a big impact on society. If, however, we're making implants or brain connections or various kinds of artificial beings for medical reasons, why, then you tap into a very important need for society. Then I think you'll find that money will flow and research will just blossom. So for me, it's the medical application of this whole spectrum of possibilities that would probably make this a technology that really has a big, big impact on the U.S. and maybe the whole world.
Yeah. Well, that raises a question that you write about in Digital People, and that is, you know, speaking of economics, if we could improve brain function, if we could make ourselves smarter, would we see a further divide between those that have and those that do not have, those with sizable resources and those without?
It's always been a question in technology, and I think it's become more obvious in the last few years when we see how the world has gone. Whole societies are turning into either technological haves or technological have-nots. And then within societies, you see the very cutting-edge technology that might save a life. Well, who can afford that? I myself have a pacemaker implanted, and a pacemaker is not a cheap thing. The economics of our world and the health plan I belong to and so on made it possible for it to be implanted. If I had to pay for it myself, it might have been a different issue.
Yeah.
So we come right smack in the middle of these very, very hard issues for a democratic society. Who has access to these things? How much do they cost? Who has the rights? And not only to save a life, which you might say always takes precedence, it's always the top of the list, but how about if I can give you a chip that makes you just a bit smarter or makes your child just a bit smarter? Then who has access to that?
We have to wrap up. The time has gone so quickly. But before we go, I'm curious about this, what your thoughts are about this. In Digital People and throughout our conversation here this afternoon, we've sprinkled in references to films, to plays, to stories, to myths. These stories that in which we've explored some of these things in fiction, in science fiction, how do they inform us in terms of what do they tell us about our humanity? What do they have to say about how we are grappling with the issues, the questions that this technology raises?
You know, the wonderful thing about writers, whether they do screenplays or books or stage plays, is they think of humanity first and technology second very often. So the great thing about the science fiction side of all of this is it rubs our noses in the fact that this has human impact, that it can change the society, and you need to think very carefully about what's happening. The play written in the 1920s that gave us the word robot, called Rossum's Universal Robots, talks right away about the issues of having millions of worker robots spread through the world and what that would mean for humanity. And then you come right up to RoboCop, who was designed to be a merging of a human and a machine because a totally machine cop had gone out of control, and again makes us face these issues. So they tell us the most important thing, which is you can't let the technology happen all by itself. You need to think about where it's going to lead us.
Mm. Good point to end on. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure to talk to you and also to the caller, Celeste. Thank you.
Sidney Perkowitz has been our guest this afternoon. His latest book is Digital People, From Bionic Humans to Androids. The book is published by the Joseph Henry Press, an imprint of the National Academies Press. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the corn pit were lower for the day. The beans were mixed with the nearby July up. The August was lower, and the deferreds were up as well. From the wheat pit this afternoon, July futures were down a penny at 340.5, at 337.5 on their settlement price, down a penny. The high was at 340.5. Their low at 335, that for the July contract in the wheat pit. September futures 350 on the high, the low at 345. A settlement price today at 347.25, and they were down 0.75 cents. December futures 361, the high, the low at 356.5, settled at 360.25, up 1. And the March futures at 370.5, the high, the low at 367, settled 369.75, up 1.75. And the May futures 373, the high, the low at 371, and a settlement price at 372.5, a penny and a half higher. From the corn pit, July futures 274, the high, the low at 266.5, a settlement price at 268, down 3.25 for the corn in the nearby July contract today. September futures 278.25, the high, the low at 271.5, and a settlement price at 272.5. They were down 2.5 cents. December on out, trading in the penny unchanged area, 282.25, the high, the low at 276.25, settlement price at 277.5, and the December contract, it was a penny and a half lower for the day. That is some position squaring taking place before tomorrow morning's acreage report is released from USDA, along with the quarterly grain stocks report. March contract 288.25, the high, the low at 283, settlement price at 283.75, down 1.75. Also happens to be the end of the month, and it could be an interesting day tomorrow depending on what USDA's reports say. May futures in the corn pit 292.75 high, low at 287.5. A settlement price at 289, they were down a penny and 3/4. July contract 295, the high, the low at 290. Settlement price at 291.25, down 1. And September futures 281.5, the high, the low at 278.5. Settled 278.75, a penny and 3/4 lower. December unchanged on the day, 269, the high, the low, and settlement price all at 267. That for the December 2005 corn contract. July oats 144, the high, the low at 139.25. A settlement price there at 139.75, down 3.25, and the September futures down 2 cents on the day. 149.75, the high, the low at 145, settled a half cent above that at 145.5. July soybeans now 902, the high, the low at 890, settlement price at 894.5. Quite a nice jump after yesterday's big losses, up 9.5 cents on the day in the July contract. August 818, the high, the low at 804, settlement price at 805.5. They were down 2 there. September futures now 4.5 higher, 734, the high, the low at 723, settled 726.5. And the November contract, 705, the high, low at 694, settled 699.75. Up 11.25 for the day. January soybeans 706.5, the high, the low at 696, a settlement price at 702.5, up 12.5 cents. And the March futures in the bean pit 704, the high, the low at 696, $7 even the trade. At the end of the day for the settlement in that March contract, it was 11 cents higher. The May futures were up 12, 693, the high, the low at 685, and a settlement price at 691. July bean meal 301 high, low at 292.50, settled 293.30, down 70. And the August 280, the high, the low at 273.60, settled 273.80. That was up 50 on the day. July bean oil for the day 28.85, the high, the low at 28.40, settled 28.75, and they were up 23. And the August contract 28.08, the high, high, the low at 27.55, settlement price at 27.93, and they were up 40 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Livestock prices higher today. August feeder cattle, the high 112.30, the low 110.20, the settlement 112.02.5, up 87.5. September 110.80, the high 108.25, the low 110.52.5, the settlement that up 117.5. October feeder cattle 108.65, the high 106.80, the low 108.35, the settlement that up 120. June live cattle 88.85, the high 87.40, the low 88.80, the settlement that up 170. August 88.55, the high 86.30, the low 87.87.5, the settlement that up 145. July lean hog 77.65, the high, the low 76.50, the settlement 77.50, that up 45. August 76.15, the high 74.95, the low 75.87.5, the settlement that up 35. October 65.55, the high 64.45, the low 65.50, the settlement that up 37.5. December lean hog 60.60, the high 60.05, the low, the final price 60.50, that up 7.5. July bellies 117.30, the high 115.65, the low 116.95, the settlement that up 57.5. The Dow's up 62 points at 10,419. The NASDAQ 13 higher at 2032. The S&P 500 up 3 points at 1137.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau and IFB's AgriVisor Market Advisory Service. AgriVisor offers market information and advice on the web to Illinois and Indiana Farm Bureau members at agrivisor.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Buddy Guy from Shreveport, Louisiana writes, Dear Dr. Science, I can't find a needle for my turntable's tone arm. Should I just give up and buy a compact disc player?
By now, a large portion of the populace owns at least one CD player. Those who don't and probably never will fall into two groups, the folks with hearing damage, and the sturdy iconoclasts who hang on to their gummy 8-track tape players or their Montgomery Ward hi-fis. These people are missing out on the piercing highs and destructive lows a compact disc can put out. Music that can hurt. Yes, the CD player is a weapon. Like most arms, it should never be pointed at anyone in jest.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science CD and master's degree mouse pad, call 800-989-DUCK. Visit Dr. Science on the web at www.drscience.com.